Welcome to Committing Faith in Public. This is the podcast for people who want to be inspired by individuals and communities of faith doing good work in public. Our guests tell stories of their work of weaving a more just, kind, and diversity-inclusive society. Our starting place for stories is Oklahoma because that is where we live, and because many people, both in Oklahoma and beyond, are surprised when they learn that interreligious friendly, pro-democracy, diversity welcoming, public good-oriented religion even exists in Oklahoma. So through this podcast, we're spreading good news and encouraging you in your faith and public life work. I'm Gary Peluso-Verden, President Emeritus at Phillips Theological Seminary in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and working on the Religion and Public Life Initiative for the seminary. Welcome, everyone, and I'm here today, not actually here, I am here in my home, and Toby Jenkins, are you at home or are you at the office today?
I am at the house.
At the house. Talking with Toby Jenkins, who's the executive director of the Oklahoma Equality Center, and kind of a full disclosure, and a fellow churchgoer at Boston Avenue United Methodist with me. Welcome, Toby, and so glad that in the midst of everything else going on, you can take a little time and chat with me on Committing Faith in Public.
Thank you. Good. I'm excited for any human interaction.
That's great. Me too. Me too. And expanding beyond one's own immediate household is sometimes also pleasant. First, tell our listeners who may or may not be familiar, what is the Oklahoma Equality Center?
It's actually called Oklahomans for Equality, and Oklahomans for Equality is the oldest and largest LGBTQ rights organization in about 40 states. We're celebrating our 40th anniversary. We were founded in the 1970s by a young attorney by the name of Dennis Neal and his collaborative friends, who felt like that if they did not organize and begin to advocate for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and queer individuals, that they would never see situations improve their state, their home state of Oklahoma. The name of the organization is Oklahomans for Equality, and we have right now about 11 active chapters across the state of Oklahoma, and about another 21 that are either in development or we have strong relationships with folks who want to organize in their communities. Then our headquarters is the Dennis Arnell Equality Center, which is obviously named after our founder. But it's also where we provide direct services, programs, activities, and do outreach at the downtown Tulsa. And we've been at that location for 15 years. Prior to that, we had about a decade of other community center locations where the landlords would make us move because the neighbors complained either we were being vandalized or harassed. And so we finally just spent several years raising money to buy our own building. Thought that would be the difficult part. But once we had the money to purchase a building, no bank in Tulsa at that time would loan us money.
And when was that? 15 years, you say?
That would have been in the late 90s and the early 2000s.
Not at all long ago.
And we thought the difficult part would be raising the money, and then we would identify a property. And because our programs are so extensive, we have medical service programs, counseling programs, lots of social programs. We needed the building to be accessible to people with disabilities. We needed it to be close to a bus route. You know, we had lots of specific needs that our community had told us that they were requiring. And so that meant we had to go meet with the Board of Adjustment to get approval to purchase the properties. 50 times we were turned down. Properties that the neighbors would not let us purchase the property. They were dead set against us being in their neighborhood. They didn't want an LGBT center. They called it a sex shop, or it defied God's principles. Mm-hmm. It would bring judgment on the city of Tulsa. And so finally we identified the property, which is an old torpedo factory in downtown Tulsa. Mm-hmm. We purchased that building. Nobody cared. Nobody showed up at the Board of Adjustment meeting. It was downtown Tulsa. You know, it was an urban decay, mm-hmm. empty warehouse districts. It had downtown. It just turned into old abandoned warehouse districts. And after 5 o'clock on most Fridays, everything pretty well cleared out. Mm-hmm. And so nobody cared that we were wanting to purchase a property in downtown Tulsa. Mm-hmm. Living Art was kind of the only thing that was in the neighborhood, and they were fine with us being there because mm-hmm. They valued relationships with creative class. So mm-hmm. we've been in downtown Tulsa all these, which is not too long, just, since 2005. Purchased the building October 31st, 2005, and it was a pretty emotional day. First time we'd ever been allowed to raise a rainbow flag on top of our own building, mm-hmm. and as our previous landlords would not let us do that. Mm-hmm. So the Dennis Arnold Equality Center is actually the headquarters of Oklahomans for Equality, and it is one of the programs of Oklahomans for Equality.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I really appreciate that clarification, something I should have known since, as you know, I've been a friend of the center for quite some years now. So I will try to get the center and Oklahomans for Equality correct in the way I talk about them too. How long have you been executive director?
I've been the paid executive director going on 12 years. August was starting my 12th year. And then prior to that, I was the board president. We didn't have an executive director.
Okay.
I was like the interim executive director for 2 years prior to that. Mm-hmm. I've been involved with the organization ever since I came out back in the 90s. And my first involvement with them was I had just recently come out, and Oklahoma legislators had a bill that would have stopped you from gay people from having custody of their mm-hmm. children. I was mm-hmm. in the middle of a divorce, and mm-hmm. so I reached out to them. I was familiar with them. I'd known about them for years, and so I reached out to them, called the phone number that they've had forever, and got involved then. And they were kind of suspect of me because I came from a very conservative mm-hmm. religious background, mm-hmm. a very conservative political background. Mm-hmm. I'd been in county government. Only thing they trusted me to do was to pick up trash and clean the porta potties at Pride. Mm-hmm. And I was just mm-hmm. tickled to death to be around people like me. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I was suited just perfect, and I made sure those porta potties and those that park every time we had our Pride festival, that was spotless. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because the founder of our organization, who was a very successful businessman, mm-hmm. very respected community leader, mm-hmm. it is still pretty common to find Dennis Neal picking up trash in the alley, mm-hmm. cleaning toilets, mm-hmm. Scrubbing walls. So he set a good example for me to follow.
He sure did. Now, you alluded to coming from a conservative religious background. For the people who don't know, say a little, if you would, about your time as a Southern Baptist pastor.
I was not a Southern Baptist.
No, you weren't. Were you Pentecostal?
No. I was a Free Will Baptist.
Oh, Free Will Baptist. Oh, yes.
I'm an Armenian in theology.
Hey, good. I'm glad. Like we Wesleyans, Arminians. Okay, good.
Yes. I was a Free Will Baptist minister. Now, I grew up in the Methodist Church.
I'd forgotten that.
Family very active in that, grew up in that. And then I did not want to go to school at OU. Uh-huh. My family had ties to OU, and so I needed to get out of town, wanted to go away. And so I went to Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee, uh-huh. and eventually connected with Free Will Baptist, and who told me I could pray the gay away. And because I had talked to people there about my struggles with my same-sex attraction, and they told me if I'd just serve Jesus more, those feelings would go away. My parents knew that I had those, they had a gay son. They were very understanding and trying to help me accept it myself and try to protect me, and I just wasn't having it. I could not see any example of that, of positive in my culture, and certainly on a normal basis didn't hear anything affirmed from the pulpit in those days. And so I gravitated towards super conservative theology as a, grabbing for some kind of straw. And I say it was like being in the middle of the ocean and not having any fresh water. You'll start drinking salt water because you think it's going to quench your thirst, but it actually dehydrates your body and will kill you. And that's what that was like, that conservative grasp, that, fundamentalist theology appealed to my fear, my anxiety over my sexuality. And I was grabbing for anything that could, what I thought would save my soul and save my life. I didn't want to be gay. I didn't. I wasn't comfortable with it. I wasn't comfortable with my own identity and my own expression. I just wanted to be different, and I did not want to have to live like that for what I saw around me. So I grabbed that and became a Free Will Baptist minister. And it was right at the time of the religious right taking over the Republican Party. My parents had been very, very close friends to Jimmy Carter and believed very strongly in progressive Democratic causes. When I changed from Democrat to Republican, my mother wouldn't speak to me for 3 months because she would just cry and look at me and say, Republicans don't love poor people, Toby. Republicans don't love poor people. And that was her fear. 40 years ago. And so I became Free Will Baptist minister, and I did that for 12 years. And the whole time I was, when I married, I told my fiance, I told the girl I was dating shortly, and I don't know how much we want to get into the details of this because it can be pretty graphic, but I did let her know that I struggle with same-sex attraction. She believed our church. I believed my church. She felt like if I was going to try to be heterosexual, that she could go along with that. And the whole time I was in the ministry, every month I would travel, sometimes be a three-hour drive. I would drive to another large urban city where I had identified a Christian therapist, and would meet with those Christian therapists trying to fix myself and trying to address what I considered was some kind of, emotional mental health flaw, and did that for 12 years. And the whole time I was I was building a very large evangelical fundamentalist churches. I was very involved in college ministry. I was slated to take over for Bill Bright. Really? Campus Crusade, because I was at the University of Missouri and had one of the largest campus ministries in the country. And so I worked on John Ashcroft's campaign to be governor for the state of Missouri. He and his wife went to my church. So, I was right there a part of conservative Christianity taking over the Republican Party and mixing of politics and faith, and so that was and then during all of that time, I was being recognized for building large churches, and our churches were integrated, our churches were full of young people, we were a part of the movement of moving towards contemporary Christian music and sale church programs, where we had little house churches all over the place, and we were doing all of that, and which meant, you know, I was at all these conferences and being recognized for that, and was very involved in March for Jesus around the world, was very involved in an organizer for the National Prayer Breakfast.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Was a part of the original group that became the Promise Keepers.
Yes.
So I was, you know, I was right there and in the middle of all of that. And of course, in the middle of that, we had the AIDS crisis, and I helped write the curriculum on how evangelical churches were supposed to care for those with AIDS. And it was a different world. I don't have any, I'm not ashamed or regret the things that I was involved in helping folk. What I do regret is that it had a personal cost to me and my family as we perpetuated and allowed others to participate in what were a very exclusionary, unchristian, uncompassionate responses to the needs of LGBTQ persons. And so when I came out, stepped down from my ministry, because I was so well known, I immediately became like a, you know, a conference speaker for evangelical conferences, evangelical churches, on what we had to do to save the homosexual. So that was my involvement. I was, you know, eventually was at First Methodist Church with under Dr. Buzz Kirk, and they used to get so frustrated with me because anytime they'd ask me to share my story or, you know, be a part of the confessing church movement, I would just use phrases like, I am a Christian who struggles with same-sex attraction. They would tell me I need to get up and say, Dr. Buzzkirk would tell me I need to get up and say, I'm a delivered, you know, I'm delivered from this. And, you know, we eventually came back to Tulsa because that's where my wife's family was from, and came back to be a part of Grace Fellowship's, their ex-gay program, which was, we were maybe involved in that for about 8 weeks and immediately were very suspicious of what we considered a lack of integrity and a lack of transparency and a lack of reality, and that we ended up at First Methodist. I came from a Methodist church, grew up in that background, and so we were there when Dr. Lance, I think that was his name, he had written a book called 51% Principle, where he was trying to do work with homosexual persons, trying to help them overcome their, what they perceived as sexual addictions. and their brokenness. I can remember Dr. Buzzkirk saying in the pulpit all the time when he would be railing about the Methodist Church debating over whether to allow LGBTQ persons into the clergy, he would say, you don't make the you don't make the patient who's sick the doctor in the intensive care unit. And I would just get so offended at that, and I would have an argument with him over it, that I talked to him about how degrading that was. That, so that was my previous background.
And in some ways, parallel to that, a lot of us religious people would acknowledge that the relationship between sexuality and religion is often a complicated one. And in Oklahoma, with the predominance of fundamentalist, evangelical, and Pentecostal Protestants as the dominant expression, those are the expressions that have had the most difficulty accepting the normativity, the normalness, the God-createdness of LGBTQ persons. And I know from previous conversations with you that there are a lot of members of your communities who really struggle with religion or have just outright rejected organized religion outright. Could you comment a little bit on the difficult relationship that your communities often have with organized religion?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's no mystery that lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer persons have experienced lots of pain and rejection and, you know, even violence and death at the hands of religious fundamentalism. And it doesn't necessarily, it's not just Christians. You know, they've experienced this from Orthodox Judaism. They experience it from radical Islam, and even, you know, everybody wants to think Buddhist or everybody get along, but there are some segments of Buddhism that have been very oppressive to people who identify as LGBTQ. So that's not a secret to anybody. What is what people may not understand is it not only makes, you know, the attack is on you personally, but your family and how your family responds to your sin. And so that's where most LGBTQ persons, I mean, occasionally I'll run across somebody who's maybe been spared some of what we call religious trauma or religious damage. Occasionally you'll run across the individual, but most everybody has had some negative impact or experience from faith and how it interacted in their family. Even in some of the most progressive families, there will be, you know, their parents will say, please don't tell our elderly grandmother. And, you know, they'll have certain people that they try to keep it a secret from, and that's because of that person's deeply held religious positions on certain things like that. And I doubt there's ever been an LGBTQ person who's not had at least one well-meaning religious person who tried to tell them that they either aren't trying hard enough, or that if they continue to live that way or love that way, that they're going to be punished eternally, or they're never going to be happy, or it's going to lead to all sorts of horrible things in their lives, and that if they'll just do certain things, if you'll just deny who you are, refuse to allow yourself to have any kind of intimacy or tenderness or companionship in your personal life, then you can eventually overcome this and reject these things, and you can be normal like everybody else. You can be normal and happy like everybody else. And I doubt there's ever been any person who identifies as LGBTQ who's not been exposed to that kind of hardcore, hard sell, full court press of, you know, you can change because there's something wrong with you, and if you just take these steps, this is your path to deliverance. It is usually at the base of most all any kind of desire to strip LGBTQ people of equal rights or to pass discriminatory laws. You rarely have those bills being introduced or those ordinances being introduced that you don't have some elected official who quotes the Bible as the motivation for doing what they do.
And we have extensive experience with that in Oklahoma.
Yes, it happens all the time. Happened this session.
Yes,
you know,
right.
We were dealing with, and we're session still not over, so we may have it drop on us like it has in other states. But they'll quote the Bible or quote some kind of religious text as justification of why they need to codify some kind of law, ordinance, or statute to punish us. I mean, right now, while you and I are having this conversation, we're waiting on the Supreme Court's decision over workplace protections and employment security for LGBTQ persons in the workplace. And we will be, whatever happens, whether it goes in our favor or it goes against us, there will be a pushback immediately across the country, where religious conservative people in state houses and courthouses and city halls will try to push back against whatever the Supreme Court decides that might positively guarantee workplace protections for LGBTQ persons. We saw this happen with marriage equality. Mm-hmm. The state of Oklahoma mm-hmm. introduced 32 bills the year after marriage mm-hmm. equality. We've got to, this approach that we've got to stop it. Mm-hmm. Still to this day, it's popular in some legislative circles to brag that you're going to restrict marriage equality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's popular in some circles. And at the same time, have there also been interactions you've had with religious leaders that you've been pleasantly surprised at? And that's in addition to the progressive religious leaders around town.
I can tell you that there are many in the city of Tulsa who still are in religious faith communities and positions of power and positions of authority and influence who secretly do not believe, accept, mm-hmm. or support their particular religious institution's positions on this. Hmm. There is a secret society of religious leaders in the city who are in very, very powerful positions, mm-hmm. and they secretly believe that their religious institution has it dead wrong. It's not compatible with sacred texts. It's not compatible with the spirit of Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's not compatible with humanity and compassion and the mm-hmm. things we're called to. Mm-hmm. But they're stuck in positions where they have to continue to stay in their denominations or stay in their pulpits or stay in their religious communities. But you won't necessarily see those individuals preaching mm-hmm. the dogma or propaganda. Mm-hmm. But they also continue to stay in those communities. And, maybe they feel like they're trying to influence them mm-hmm. and change them by their positions or their approaches. So I could tell you that if I die... I will have to die with that secret, those mm-hmm. secrets.
Right, right.
Because I've had multiple prominent clergy persons in the city who have met with me privately to tell me in their particular ministry, they're not going to be a part of exclusionary, violent attacks on the mm-hmm. LGBTQ community, mm-hmm. even though the name on their church mm-hmm. or their religious institution, their official position is. Then you have the second, what I call the second level. You have individuals who are in institutions that have policies and church polity that will not allow them to bless same-sex unions or will not allow LGBTQ persons to seek licensing ordination. Mm-hmm. Then you have the level of those clergy persons who are actually renegades within their own religious mm-hmm. movements where mm-hmm. they have made their position clear on what they believe and their address, they're dealing with the tension in their own mm-hmm. private congregations. Mm-hmm. Maybe their whole congregation is not 100% on board and they're having to work through that, but yet they've said, this is my position, this is what I believe. Mm-hmm. And then the next level, I would say, is there are those same individuals who are almost renegades in their own religious movements, and they've led their whole congregation to take the official position mm-hmm. that we're going to welcome LGBTQ people, and they're going to do it in defiance mm-hmm. of their mm-hmm. denomination or their religious institutions. And then finally, you get down to what I call the fourth level, are individuals who are religious leaders who are either a part of religious institutions that have made the decision to be places of inclusion mm-hmm. and welcome and affirm LGBTQ persons, mm-hmm. and their religious communities are known for their progressive, compassionate way, and they are also advocates and strong, militant voices about this is wrong, what's being done by other religious communities, and they call it out and they denounce it and they're prophetic. And they've done this enough that they've been able to influence their entire religious movement. So, you know, we have four levels of what I consider allies or, you know, voices in the wilderness for crying out, prepare the way of the Lord. And then, in even if you drop that into in every congregation, faith community, we have an element of people who sit in the pew who see this different than what their own church is, and they're safe individuals within that. I get occasionally challenged by people who feel like it's dangerous for the Equality Center to list some congregations because some of those congregations may not have taken the official step to be inclusive official. And my position is, as long as they're not hearing from the pulpit, as long as they're not hearing from the pulpit that they're broken and disordered and sinful and need to repent, that, you know, if they're hearing from the pulpit that all persons are of incredible worth to you, to the Lord, and that they're loved and valued, to me, that place can be a welcoming congregation. I've had individuals say, well, if you allow them to, you know, first of all, we don't even acknowledge or recognize religious communities unless the senior leadership has officially sent us some kind of documentation requesting that they be listed on our faith page. And our faith page on our website for Oklahomans for Equality, it designates, you know, some of these congregations, they can't do same-sex weddings, or they can't ordain LGBTQ persons, but they are still welcoming, inclusive churches. And so I've had individuals say, well, you're sending them to churches where they're still not working that out. If they've not taken the official step, followed the official process, they're going to have horrible things said to them. And this is what I would say to that. I've been going to church my entire life. I've been going to church my entire life. I have never been in any church that I didn't have somebody say something hurtful and harmful to me. Regardless of who I am and who I love or whatever. You know, I've been, I was a part of the Metropolitan Community Church, which was an LGBT organization church that was started by LGBT persons. I was a part of St. Jerome's Parish, you know, which was a breakaway from the Episcopal Church and had a Catholic, you know, had a, had a, an openly gay clergy person. And some of the things that were said to me in those congregations made some of the other stuff that was said to me in places where I was, my presence was resented, make it look like a walk in the park. And so I just refuse to limit our ability to be able to find, help people find help. And so we're still, you know, I rarely have a week that I don't. I've had two this week because I guess COVID has given plenty of time to, for clergy persons to be contemplative because they can't hold, can't hold services. But I've had two congregations reach out to me this week where they wanted me to know that if an LGBTQ person needed anything, that they would be happy to bring them communion, or they would be happy to come and pray with them during this time of anxiety. I always like to take the opportunity to say this. It is very common for us to have interns who are students from faith-based universities in the region as interns at our at the center. We usually have, in the course of the semester, we'll have between 18 to sometimes as many as 30 interns from universities.
I had no idea. Yeah.
Yeah, they're either social work interns or they're mental mm-hmm. health provider, mm-hmm. you know, mental health interns or even going to be doctors mm-hmm. or school teachers, and they'll do their internship for us. I mean, we have it all up and down the level. We have TCC students and Tulsa Technology nursing students who do internships with us. And we never have a semester that we don't have at least 2 to 3 or 4 students who are from faith-based universities. We had 2 students this semester from Oral Roberts University, mm-hmm. and this would be mm-hmm. the 6th semester that mm-hmm. we've had mm-hmm. Oral Roberts University students. We sat down and made sure they clearly understood mm-hmm. our position, mm-hmm. where we're mm-hmm. at, and I will tell you, our faith-based university interns, student university interns, are usually some of our most dependable. Maybe a part of the programs they're involved. Mm-hmm. You have to show up and do the work and follow through. And I've also noticed that they have a heart to serve. Mm-hmm. So if I need them to clean out trash cans, mm-hmm. they'll do that. And they'll act like it's just as important as doing something that looks more official.
Mm-hmm.
I took Christian University students with us to the Capitol to witness the interactions when mm-hmm. we take high school mm-hmm. students to the legislature, mm-hmm. and they were just absolutely heartbroken and appalled mm-hmm. and almost turned into protector shields mm-hmm. that when these legislators mm-hmm. would start going after these high school students, they would just whip out their Bible and start debating them, and they said they were just horrified at how elected officials would treat, especially our LGBTQ youth, when we had taken them to the mm. Capitol to advocate mm. mm-hmm. And to, you know, stand up against oppressive bills that were trying to be being pushed mm. through the Senate. Mm.
Wow. Toby, we're out of time, and I want to say I always enjoy talking to you. I so admire the work you're doing, and I'm so glad you're doing that work. And thanks so much, especially in this sort of very unusual time, at least we hope it's unusual that we're living through right now, to take some time with me and be on Committing Faith in Public, which I think, regardless of whether you identify with your former clergy self or not, you're doing this. This seems like a ministry to you, and I so appreciate what you're doing.
Well, Gary, I'll tell you, this week, during this time of COVID, I've had 5 deaths, not COVID deaths, mm-hmm. but we've had 5 persons mm-hmm. who died. They've either, you know, they've died or had a death that I had to go and see them in mask and gloves to try to provide comfort to their families. We've had a bunch of people who've been hospitalized. Obviously, I can't go to the hospital mm-hmm. to see them, mm-hmm. but I've had to call them and talk to them while they're in the hospital or while they're really sick. And so I'm going to be the closest they're mm-hmm. going to get to mm-hmm. any kind of mm-hmm. clergy support.
Right.
Because they're willing to trust me. And lots of times I'll say to them, would you like for me to have a word of prayer? I always ask permission. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. many times they say, I'd rather not. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a believer. And mm-hmm. I said, okay. And then they'll say things, but you know what, if you can read a poem, that would, mm-hmm. and so I've mm-hmm. got a few poems that I use mm-hmm. to comfort them. Mm-hmm. So I tell people I've learned to pray the best agnostic, mm-hmm. atheist, secular prayer that can be prayed,
yeah.
so that
yeah.
I don't, you know, insult them, but I want to provide comfort yeah. for them. So thank you so much for letting us talk.
Same. You take care, and thanks. Bye.
This has been Committing Faith in Public, a podcast from the Religion and Public Life Initiative at Phillips Theological Seminary in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Copyright PTS and Gary Peluso-Verdend. The views and opinions expressed during the podcast are those of the individuals and do not necessarily reflect an official position of Phillips Theological Seminary.